Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. It is Thursday, January 15th, 2015. Tonight we're bringing you episode 42 from Carolyn Jaeger Uncensored on Blog Talk Radio. I am Carolyn.
And I'm Ray.
I think that this is another one of those really good sessions that we're going to have tonight, but it's always just a few things that Hitler comes up with in some of these sessions that I think is so great. I'm happy to see it. And so
yes.
I think that it's all very good, you know.
I agree.
You know, I also, this is an active period on the Eastern Front. I've been reading about the fall of Sevastopol, and there's a lot to say about that. But right now, before that comes up, we have a timeline here for July 28th, and it tells us that Case Blue, the German plan to capture Stalingrad and the Soviet Union oil fields in the Caucasus, begins, and says that generally forces are shifted to the south. Well, the battle for Sevastopol is going on, and they know they're going to get it, but it's slow to fall. So they've started already their next move. Different forces, of course, on the field out there, but.
Uh-huh.
But we have a timeline about that, too. All this going on, and, you know, I was reading about Sevastopol and the effort that it took, the sustained fighting and bombing and so on, and the Soviets were able to hold on so well. And that little piece of land, you know, cost so many men and materiel for that little piece of land, and I was just thinking about that, you know, like, 20,000 Germans casualties.
Uh-huh.
You know what it costs to gain a little foothold, and then to lose it again later is such. It must be a terrible frustration,
yep.
Disappointment. Would be for me. I'd say, my God,
oh, yeah.
What do we do all that for? You know, but that's not the attitude you're supposed to have. Well, the other timeline for this. These are for the 28th, and it's MRSA. Matru, Egypt, has it's about 140 miles from Alexandria, and that falls to Rommel, which was good news.
Yeah.
And we had discussed that last week some.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay,
sure.
So any comments from you, or you just want to start? Whatever.
No, we can go ahead and take right off here. 29th June, 1942,
yeah. Okay.
midday. Belgrade and the Danube. The Danube, a German stream. Tasks of the future. Bismarck, Holstein, and Ludwig of Bavaria. My Viennese compatriots ask continuously whether we shall once more abandon Belgrade. Now that we've captured the place for the third time, they say we ought to stick to it. The Viennese are right in their opinion, at least insofar as we must exercise the greatest care when defining the frontiers in this corner. One thing is quite certain. In no circumstances can we renounce our claim to the so-called Iron Gates. The Danube is a river that runs deep into the heart of the continent, and for this reason must, in a new Europe fashioned by us, be regarded as a German stream and be controlled by Germany. The organization of the whole east-west traffic in this great territory depends on whether the Danube is or is not to be a German waterway. Any canal construction would be superfluous, indeed stupid, if we didn't hold unrestricted control of this main channel. In the handling of the Danubian problems, our generation must remember that not all the questions of rights which arise were successfully answered by the peace treaties. Any responsible statesman should, indeed must, leave his successor a whole drawer full of somewhat nebulous claims so that the latter can be in a position, should the need arise, to conjure up these sacred rights as the pretext for any conflict which may seem necessary.
Now, let me
Himmler,
just interfere
yeah.
here. And it's true, we're going to learn here that Himmler is present in this at this time.
Right.
But... you know, I thought that was so interesting and also so intelligent. And I'm not saying that it's only Hitler that realizes this, because later he kind of implies that they all function this way. pretty much, that you have to be ready to pounce on opportunities and say that you have a right to this or to that when it comes up. If you don't have that, somebody else is going to do it, and you're going to be left in the
right
breach. So it's kind of a proactive attitude.
Yeah.
That
sure,
it's not so clear. You should have these things ready because other people are going to do that, and you might end up being the one with the best claim. So.
Oh yeah, and you know that's a good point. And where he says any canal construction would be superfluous if we didn't hold unrestricted control of the Danube River. Which makes perfect sense, and that's why he said, claims of the Danube being a German stream from start to finish are rather shaky. But if we don't control that river, to try to build canals off of it and whatever would be a total loss, because whoever controls the river then is going to control those canals and the water that goes to them. So it makes a lot of sense. Like you said, it's shaky ground, but it's something you have to lay out and make those claims, as he points out that that others have done prior to what he's saying here.
Right. And then here's where he says, talking about the Danube, saying it's a river that runs deep into the heart of the continent, and for this reason must, in a new Europe fashioned by us, be regarded as a German stream and be controlled by Germany. So I think that's very revealing. And, you know, what came to my mind was that a major reason the Allies had to destroy Germany was because they wanted to fashion the new Europe themselves. They were all ready to fashion the new Europe. And, in fact, in their the Allies have fashioned a new world. It's telling us that Hitler, and I've been kind of resistant to this idea, but here he's saying it again, and Himmler's there, and it's always between Hitler and Himmler they're talking about this, that they understand together that what they're doing, that there's going to be a new Europe. You could see that after World War One, I suppose, everything fell apart, you know, the monarchies and the whole system. And now with the rise of the Third Reich and the Soviet Union and so on, and Bolshevism, communism, that something new has to come out of this, and they want to be the ones to do it. But he's only talking about a Europe. He's not talking about the world, you know, conquering the world or anything. He's just talking about refashioning Europe. And as we've discussed before on here, he honestly believed, and I think he was right, that Germans were the best ones to do it. But in any case, he is reinforcing this idea here, which I just thought was very interesting.
Right.
As a matter of fact, I was thinking just a little bit ago that I should eventually go through this, the actual book that I have on my pages here, and pick out all these things that stood out so much to me that Hitler has said. A whole lot of them have to do with race that interest me a whole lot. And some other things, because I've got them all in boldface or in big type or, you know, and read around them and so on from comments. So it wouldn't be hard to find and pick out all the ones that mean a lot to me and put them all together so that I have a kind of a record of that I can refer to.
Well, that's very good because, you know, as I read this little section right here, what we just talked about, and you made the remark about World War One causing so many changes, I read a very informative book. Gosh, it must have been around 1991 or two, called The Kings Depart. It was by a fellow named Richard M. Watt. And it was the story of how many nations were totally changed by World War One, and the Habsburg dynasty and all these kings. Everything was falling apart, and there were different forms of government and different alignment and territory stolen and things like this. And this very section that we just now said a few words about, it falls right into that stuff that I read, 25 years ago or whatever it was. And it's, you can't know, you can't understand what we're reading about right now regarding 1942 if you don't have any kind of background in 1914 to 1921, you know, right in that era.
Mm, right.
So,
good point.
Himmler made the remark that old Fritz based his Silesian campaign upon hereditary rights, which were by no means well established, and that Louis XIV again and again had recourse to legal titles, no matter whence they were obtained, in support of his policies. Hitler continued, "The head of a state can give no better proof of his wisdom than the leaving of claims of this kind to his successor in respect of every region in which it is humanly possible to foresee that any national interest may at any possible time become involved. If the monks of Athos, on the subject of whose morals I have no desire to dilate, wish to name me a successor to the Byzantine Empire, then their document must be most carefully preserved. I do not wish archives," yeah, I'm going to laugh at that too. "I do not wish archives of this nature to be kept in the Foreign Office, where they would probably be lost sight of and forgotten. They should be kept in the Chancellery as personal papers of the Chancellor and available at any time for the study of his successors. These reflections of mine are inspired by my own experience with the difficult piece of history to which I have had to put my hand. The generations which follow us will no doubt accept without comment the unification of Europe which we are about to accomplish, in the same way as the majority of our contemporaries regard the foundation of the Bismarckian Empire as a simple fact of history. The immense labor involved in the welding of Northern, Western, Central, and Eastern Europe into one entity will be quickly forgotten, and that is why one only appreciates at their full value such accessories as I have just described when one has the most urgent need of making use of them. There's one point I must stress in this connection, and I cannot stress it too often or too strongly, and that is that this welding together of Europe has not been made possible by the efforts of a number of statesmen devoted to the cause of unification, but by force of arms. The welding together of Bavaria, Württemberg, Baden, and so on with Prussia into the German Reich of Bismarck was not accomplished thanks to the high-minded undertaking of the princes, but by the power of the Prussian pen-firing rifle. Just think of the means that Count Holstein had to employ to persuade King Ludwig of Bavaria to write his famous letter to Bismarck, in which he proposed that the King of Prussia should reassume the title and dignity of Emperor, and which represented the last link in the chain of diplomatic negotiations. King Ludwig strove by the most childish tricks to avoid signing the letter. He even went so far as to take to his bed with a pretended toothache. And what a piece of luck it was that Holstein was not one of those wretched creatures who sink respectfully to the ground at the sight of a closed kingly door, but at the decisive moment marched right up to it and opened it.
He opened the door to King Ludwig, yeah.
That's right. Yeah. To sign that letter, hoping that the King of Prussia would automatically assume the role of emperor.
Right, and Ludwig did it, but he was really reluctant to do it.
Right.
But this count kind of pushed it along, so we're thankful to him.
Right.
Okay, well, now here he's got, you know, you might want to discuss this first. Speaking of the unification was not due to the statesman's work, but by force of arms.
Yes, and that was accented in the text, and I thought rightfully so, you know, rightfully so.
Yeah, capitalized, force of arms.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, and had the matter been left to these efforts of a number of statesmen, nothing would ever have been accomplished. But because of by force of arms, hey, we're going to make things better for everyone by unification.
Yeah, and saying that you just can't, that these states, this notion that we have, and this is what the UN is based on, this is what the League of Nations was based on, and a lot of these things, is that, well, we're going to all get together and we're going to create peace on earth and work well together and do all by just talking here in our assembly hall and discussing everything and giving everybody a voice and blah, blah. That never does anything. Just like parliamentary procedures don't do things because you have all these different sides and they never get finished arguing unless you force a vote or something, and you know the vote works. But in this other case, Hitler is saying that the only time things have really gotten done was through force of arms. I think it's not even just these unification agreements, but a whole lot of other things.
That's right.
Yeah, and he admits it. And no, but these others, they won't admit it because they want to be against. They're the biggest warmongers, the governments of the world today, but they don't want to admit that they believe in such force of arms. But Hitler admitted it because he was always telling the truth.
Right. And there were so many claiming mine, 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 and that's why nothing could ever get done, because it was it was no ours, let's do this for our benefit. It was, yeah, but what about me? What about mine? And as you correctly mentioned, the parliamentary exercises are the same way, the very same way.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that was one of the most attractive features of National Socialism. When the party was first formed and grew and grew and grew, it was pushing the idea of O-U-R, our, not mine, mine, mine. And it was constantly stressed to do what's right for the fatherland and not for Bavaria, and things like this. It was a unification thing. That's what I think. That was the main strength at the start of National Socialism, was a unification, trying to get people of very divergent viewpoints and wishes to join up and say, hey, as a greater whole, as a one, we can make a whole lot more progress than always nipping at each other's heels.
Right. We're going on to the 30th of June, and the timeline for the 30th is United States deploys second corps to the European theater. Now, I took a quick look at that. I mean, it was just the first group of soldiers, first troops that the United States actually had in Europe, and they were there from that corps. Was Patton was in that corps, and what were some of the other names?
It was in North Africa.
Patton was.
Yes.
Then they went up into Europe, but they were there from the earliest, and they were there to the end. So that was one of the main fighting divisions, I guess. More than a division, it's a corps.
That's right. U.S. troops got their first taste of the European conflict in Morocco and in North Africa. And Patton was there, and of course, as things progressed and the Germans got overwhelmed with supplies and men and whatever, then that's when the invasion of Europe started, and Patton and his group went up through Italy, making their way to Germany. But that's right.
Okay.
That's a good point.
Thank you.
Okay. June the 30th, 1942, at dinner. War as an inspiration in art, the protection of daubers, reform of the art academies, the German Museum of Art. This war is stimulating the artistic sense much more than the last war. The works of the artist whom I have recalled from the front after a year or two in the field bear the hallmark of personal experience and are among the most valuable examples of present-day art that our exhibitions can show. These war paintings establish beyond discussion that the real artist is ripened by his own personal experience in life and not by study in some art academy. Most of the academy professors lack both the insight and the judgment necessary to bring real talent to the fore. Recall, if you will, how the beautiful landscapes of von Bock were refused by the Prussian Academy, although in their wonderful sweep they alone of current paintings gave a true picture of the northern seas. This same Prussian Academy, which rejected these pictures, was, however, not ashamed to adorn its walls with absolute muck. Even in my exhibition in the House of German Art, they always try to gain acceptance for the daubs of their own protégés. But when it comes to flinging these confections out, I am exceptionally obstinate. My views on the value of the academies are well known, and under present conditions, it's difficult to see how talent, other than that which in practical life is incapable of producing a real picture, can be injected into the art schools as they are now constituted. The alternatives for the selection of teachers for an art academy of the present type are quite simple. Either one appoints capable artists as teachers, thereby losing their services in the field of creative art, or one fills the academies with non-entities and leaves the young artistic idea with nothing on which to model itself. When one thinks over this problem, the first and foremost question one must ask oneself and answer is whether, after all, it is not in the best interest of artistic creation that all the daubers should be concentrated in the academies. If, for instance, in an academy like the Film Academy, we had not only Herr Weidemann, but also our really greatest film producers, would not the quality of our film creation degenerate sharply? It is a characteristic of the present-day academies that they invariably try to stifle genius. No sooner does a real genius make his appearance in the circle of these very moderate bigwigs of the academies than up they rise with their whole plumage ruffled in wrath against him. If we wish to smooth the way for an incipient genius in the academies and ensure him a practical livelihood in spite of the academies, then we must radically alter the whole structure of the academic world. They must be split up into a series of individual studios on the lines of the state studios. Then the greatest artist available must be approached and asked if they would care voluntarily to take over one of these studios. Those who agree must be allowed a completely free hand themselves to choose those pupils whom they consider worthy of further tuition. If we organize the academies along these lines, then all the nonsense, claptrap, and jargon, and all the juggling with mathematical formulae, a nonsense that only the sparrow-like brain of mediocrity could have conceived, will stop. And the great task of the academy will be, first, last, and always, to teach the pupil to paint. I always get angry when I think of how in the teachers' training colleges, the future school teachers are stuffed with an inchoate mass of material, when all they will be called upon to do later is teach the children the rudiments of the three R's. What special knowledge, for goodness sake, is required to teach six-year-old kiddies to say A, B, C correctly? It is equally ridiculous to try to cram children at school with all sorts of things. If you ask them 2 or 3 years after they've left school, you'll find that they have forgotten practically all about it. The curriculum of a school should be drawn up with the object of teaching the children those things which will enable them in afterlife to take their places as decent citizens, and keep the children as much as possible in the open air. We shall then have a healthy rising generation capable of roughing it without falling on their backs. Wow.
Oh, I bet that's great.
This is another one of the examples that throughout this book of his interest and his awareness of the importance of art in the life of a nation, you know, in the culture of a nation. And for him to dedicate as much thought, insight, and comment about the art academies and the allowing of genius to flourish and not be stymied by these pompous bigwigs and things like this. And he talks about this at a time when there's a full-fledged war going on and his mind has to be concerned with other things, and he's loaded down with responsibilities, but yet he still, you know, he comes out and talks about we're going to have to fix our art academies, we're going to have to make them available for the best to flourish. And that's what's always amazing to me, is his attitude on things like that.
Well, the thing is, he had experience with the academies himself, so he knows what you run into, and he wouldn't even have had to have that to know about the academies. There's that, and also, as I mentioned before, he purposely took his mind off of the war and the problems and so on at times, especially like these meal dinner times and so on, and talked about things that had nothing to do with it in order to relax his mind and get his thinking away from that so he could come back to it with maybe some fresh thinking, you know. And so that was the purpose. And Bormann spoke about that to Hermann Giesler, and Hermann Giesler knew that that's what Hitler was after when he was there and spending time with him, that Hitler wanted to talk about these other things and things that he was interested in personally, like art and like architecture, that he enjoyed so much thinking about, and he didn't really enjoy having to think about the war, even though he did it and spent most of his waking hours doing it, and I think he spent his sleeping hours too doing it. But, you know, it wasn't, it was full of pressure and worry and concern, and he was trying to think about other things. I thought it was funny that these translators talked about the children in their afterlife, which should have been later life, enable them in later life.
Carolyn, that caught my eye too, and I thought that's rather strange. But the more I looked at it, it seems like a strange phrase. And I reread it, those things which will enable them in afterlife. And, of course, he's talking about when they get out of school.
Right.
But to us, the phraseology, the afterlife, is, after they're dead and gone, but after life after school.
I think the translators kind of fall down sometimes here and maybe take it too literally from the German. I'm not sure, because they're English, and they should know that we use later life, but... All right, there's a couple of things I wanted to bring up, and that is, if I can find them now. Yeah, I love the way he calls these modern artists daubers. And it's so fitting, because that's what the paintings are. They daub paint around, you know, and try to get a thing that has some kind of excitement paint-wise looking, you know.
Right.
And then that's considered, oh, wow, that's great, because it's not realistic and it's new and different, but Hitler understands that perfectly well, so he calls them the daubers, and I just really like that. And the other thing about the he's talking about these art professors, whether to have the best artists teach the youth in the academies, then they won't be able to produce as much art, or maybe keep their attention on producing art, or whether to have these non-entities teaching. And this is so true in art schools and in universities, where they like to hire people with some kind of a name or reputation, you know, as personally successful in art, but they're never very good teachers. The more famous in the big schools, you know, the more famous and well-known they are, the worse teachers they are. They don't do anything. They just come to offer their name and walk around in the... And so what I experienced when I was in school studying art was that I wasn't taught... He says, teach the students to paint. You know, I was never taught how to paint. I was never given any instruction, any of that. It was all about daubing, you know. Well, do some daubing here and... see if you can be creative and so on. But I never learned the basic, a lot of basic things that you used to learn when you were an apprentice and so on. So he's just right on the money, if you ask me about all of this. Well, I have to go to my other page to take this one down. And we're going to July 1st, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. And there's the timeline. That on July 1st was the first battle of El Alamein. It begins as Rommel begins the first assault on British defenses. And here's where it says Sevastopol falls and the end of Red Army resistance in the Crimea. Well, I thought, you know, I was reading up on it, like I said, so I'm going to give some information here. The fall of Sevastopol is considered between the 30th of June and 4th of July. So we're right in the beginning of it here. And as the German 11th Army closed in, Stalin himself made it categorically clear that the top commanders, party, and administrative officials be brought out by submarine. And two of his main generals there were flown out at the last moment. On 30th June, LIV, what is L? Is that 100 in Roman numerals?
50.
Numbers?
50.
Oh, 50.
It's 50.
Okay.
LIV 54. Would be 54.
So that would be the 54th, which was German, launched a heavy assault supported by heavy Luftwaffe bombardment and several dozen guns Heavy fighting took place for the next 3 days, but it was becoming clear that the Soviets could not hold their increasingly untenable positions for more than a day at most. So on July 3rd, the Soviets' last line of defense was breached. The following day, the last of the Soviet defenses were overrun, and with the city finally under German control, all organized resistance collapsed. The few remaining Red Army units continued to put up scattered resistance to the south of the city, which lasted until 9th of July. So all this going on during these dinner conversations here, he's not talking about them, but it certainly was commanding everybody's attention. And Sevastopol, as I'm sure you know and a lot of the listeners know, was a siege. They had to carry out a siege for about a month or so, right, to break down the defenses. So this wasn't just a sudden battle here. This is just the end of it. And it was a tremendously costly battle, as I mentioned in the beginning. And some other things I thought were interesting, so I'm going to go on with this. These are just some items I thought was interesting. And it might even be disputed because it comes from Wikipedia, but the Germans claimed that over 90,000 Red Army soldiers had been taken prisoner. Now, the official count, they don't give them that many. And an even greater number were killed, greater number than 90,000 were killed. However, this claim appears to be overstated, as according to Soviet sources, the Soviet garrison defending Sevastopol totaled 106,000 men beforehand and received only 3,000 reinforcements during the attack, while it is known that 25,000 persons were evacuated, the overwhelming majority being either wounded soldiers or officers, evacuated on Stalin's orders. But that doesn't take away that many. You take away 25,000 and add 3,000, so you take away 22,000 from 90,000. You still got a huge number. So it's somewhere in between there, but there was a lot of losses on both sides. But I think I'm not sure they're honest about the Soviet losses. I think they would have had to have been much greater.
Well, I think that was around 80,000, you know, so.
That sounds good.
It wasn't that far off.
Yeah. And then it says, an interesting and brutal observation about the siege and its aftermath was given by Lieutenant Joseph Evokian, an Armenian, who was fighting with the Soviet forces at Sevastopol. This account was given to Lieutenant Carl A. Kaiser, USNR, so it's secondhand, and was recorded in Lieutenant Kaiser's diary. And supposedly this Armenian said about himself, he was captured, Kaiser wrote about him, he was captured at Sevastopol after 83 days of bombardment. He had fought in Odessa and Kiev. He reported that they ate their own comrades in Sevastopol and in the prison camp. And Lieutenant Evokian, this Armenian, and some of his fellow Armenian prisoners were then pressed into service by the Germans and were later captured by the crew of the USS Eberle, the DD-430. On Monday, 21st August 1944, at the Ile de Cour Caroyes, Evokian stated that the Germans told them to fight for us or starve. The Armenians were eventually turned over to Soviet authorities and may have been transported to a Soviet gulag. Then, oh, here's a little more. Soviet accounts claim that there were very few Soviet troops who survived the German onslaught. Von Manstein himself records he was in charge of that whole operation. He himself records that the Soviets preferred to blow themselves up along with the German soldiers closing in on their positions rather than surrender. Von Manstein ascribed this behavior to the ruthlessness of the commissars and to the basic contempt for human life of this Asiatic power. See, that's what the Germans mostly believed about the people they were fighting. That they had, didn't value human life the same way Europeans did, and that they called them an Asiatic power. And one last little part here that I thought was good. Oh, it fits into what's happening now. Although a success in the end, that is Sevastopol, the operation had taken much longer than the Germans had imagined. Operation Blue, Army Group South's advance towards Stalingrad and the Caucasus, was just beginning, and the German offensive would not have the 11th Army to support them. Instead of having the 11th Army to help it on its quest to capture Stalingrad, the German 6th Army under Paulus would be without crucial support. You agree with that?
Yeah. We know what happened to Paulus.
Yeah.
In the months to come, of Stalingrad.
Yeah. Well, see, that Sevastopol, that was so hard to take. It was, and it ate up so much men and material, as I said. And also, the Luftwaffe was bombing like crazy, and just, you know, they were using up all the. I guess they thought, though, that they had to do that. They had to get that first before they could go on, and they were right. So that took much that when they went to Stalingrad, they were somewhat limited, a little bit.
Well, you know, Sevastopol was such a critical location there to Crimea and the Straits and all. So it was something that couldn't be bypassed or left. In the hands of the enemy, so it's unfortunate that the price they had to pay was so very high, but the military necessity was there.
Right. The difference is that the Germans didn't have unlimited men
for fighters.
And they didn't have unlimited material and like you say, any resources, human and otherwise.
Yeah.
The Russians ended up surprised them by having practically unlimited resources. So they could take all those losses and still come back with more stuff and more people. And the Germans couldn't.
You know, that's Carolyn, that's why a lot of historians, including myself, have always seen a parallel in Germany's war, World War II, fighting against so many enemies as the American South did against the Yankees, and you know, they were so out-resourced and everything else, and initially, though, they were so full of fire and righteousness that
bravery
it took almost 2 years for the Yankees to even win a battle, but it's like a heavyweight fighting a real good middleweight. Eventually he has to give out, and they didn't have the resources, they didn't have the manufacturing, they didn't have the money to keep buying things from Europe. Some of the nations of Europe were glad to help them. And the same thing with Germany. You know, they fought the gallant fight for as long as they could. They held off the world for 4 years. But like you say, you keep fighting, you keep losing your best pilots, things like this. You keep losing your most experienced tank forces, and it has to wear down. And if the fight is not over in a hurry, then the odds start getting higher and higher against the possibility of victory.
Right. And they were fully aware of that. That's why they wanted a blitzkrieg, you know, on the Eastern Front too, but they weren't able to do it. So they knew that he only had so much time to gain a victory. But then when you saw it didn't happen, you couldn't, he wasn't about to surrender because we knew the terms, unconditional. You know,
that's right.
There was no other terms that were from the very start. That's another thing about the world order that he was fighting against. I'm done with all that. thanks for adding to that.
We move on to 1st July, 1942, midday. Corporate responsibility of the family for the individual member. Japan gives an example. The treason of the Starhembergs. Jewish blood will out. Mixture with the colored races. Roosevelt, the arch Jew. Collapse of British domination in Egypt. Repercussions on the man in the street. Turkey and the fall of Sevastopol. Two distinguished ambassadors, skillful Japanese diplomacy, and the mistakes of François Poncet. General Bodenschatz informed the Führer that a brother of Prince Starhemberg was serving in the German Air Force. Another brother, he said, who had been serving in the Army, had been dismissed by order of the Führer on account of his antecedents. The Luftwaffe hesitated to follow the precedent set without further reference to the Führer, because the Starenberg serving in the Air Force had acquitted himself nobly and had received excellent reports. The Fuhrer replied, "Families which exercise considerable political influence have also a corporate family political responsibility. If one member abuses the family influence, it is quite reasonable that the whole should bear the consequences. They are always, after all, at liberty to disassociate themselves from the family black sheep." In Japan, the principle of corporate family responsibility is so deeply rooted that every family exercising influence, whether in the army or in the political field, considers it a duty, as a matter of course, to prevent any member from doing anything contrary to the national interest. If their efforts are not successful, and they feel that the national reputation of the family has been smirched by the erring son, then all the male members commit harakiri to clear the family honor. It is this principle of corporate responsibility that must be applied in the case of the brothers of the traitor Starenberg, for the family of Prince Starenberg has for centuries been one of the most influential families in Austria, and should therefore have been fully aware of their duties toward the German community, even during the time of the Weimar Republic. But don't let us get angry about Starenberg. Let us rather rejoice over the fall of Sebastopol. Freiherr von Liebig has always been regarded as an ardent nationalist, and it was as such that he was brought to my attention. When I met him, however, I was repelled by the fellow's undeniable Jewish appearance. I was nevertheless repeatedly assured that in the family tree of the Freiherr, which went very far back, there was no vestige of non-Aryan ancestry. And now, by pure chance, we have found out that one of the Freiherr's ancestors, born at Frankfurt on Main in 1616, was a pure 100% Jew. And so, although more than 300 years separate the present Freiherr from his Jewish ancestor, and although, with this one exception, all his ancestors were pure Aryans, he nevertheless has all the unmistakable racial characteristics of the Jew. This confirms the opinion I have already expressed when speaking about the Englishman, Cripps, that all half-caste families, even if they have but a minute quantity of Jewish blood in their veins, produced regularly, generation by generation, at least one pure Jew. Roosevelt affords the best possible proof of the truth of this opinion. Roosevelt, who both in his handling of political issues and in his general attitude behaves like a tortuous, pettifogging Jew, himself boasted recently that he had noble Jewish blood in his veins. The completely Negroid appearance of his wife is also a clear indication that she, too, is a half-caste. Such examples should open the eyes of all reasonable people and be a warning of the menace that half-castes can be. A complete assimilation of foreign blood is not possible, and the characteristics of the foreign race inevitably continue to reappear. Our people, therefore, is only harming itself if it accepts half-castes into the Wehrmacht and thus admits them to a position of equality with pure-blooded Germans. We cannot accept the responsibility of burdening our bloodstream with the addition of further foreign elements. Exceptions in favor of half-castes must therefore be reduced to a minimum.
Well, okay, then we're going on to another subject here. So,
exactly.
So we don't forget this. Maybe we'll comment. As you can imagine, this is one of my most favorite passages from Table Talk. Well, there's a lot of things I like about it.
Yes.
I like his the stories about what's going on in some of these families and the fact that they look at the ancestry of different people and say, oh, they're all Aryan. We don't find anything wrong in there. And they don't, but somehow they miss something, you know. Sometimes things are missed. So he said that he met this man and he struck him as a Jew. And then it turned out maybe they went back and looked again at his request. I don't know. But that there was one in 1616. They found one.
Yeah.
A full Jew. And he's saying that they're going to crop up all the time, no matter how much time goes by, that if you've got some of that foreign blood, it's going to come up in sometimes in one person who is just a total example of that.
Yeah.
It's not just a little bit in a lot of people, maybe in a lot of them, that it doesn't show up at all, but somebody's going to come along and they're going to be that foreign-blooded being. And then he says Roosevelt is the best possible proof. So there again, and he brings up Cripps, that horrible Englishman. And I didn't know that about him, but he says he's a half-caste something, and maybe he's Jewish, part Jewish. He's talking about Roosevelt there, too. And he believed that Roosevelt, and it's true that Roosevelt did say that he thought he might be, or he probably, then another time he probably
Jewish
was.
Blood.
Yeah. And I like the reference to the Negroid appearance of the wife. because I wouldn't have thought of her as Negroid, but more Jewish too. But you can see where he gets that. But that shows me though that people who want to say that Hitler was friendly with all these different races and so on, he may have been cordial to individuals and known how to treat people. But the race in general, like the Negro race, he felt had no part in German life, none, and that gives. That, of course, what comes to my mind with something like this is Veronica Clark and her black Nazis and her idea that Hitler became so friendly to other races that he was accepting them into German, because she found a couple of examples of some Negro who was living in Germany. But what did you want to say, Ray?
I laughed a while ago when I read that about where it says the completely Negroid appearance of his wife. Was because that is the first time that I have heard that since I was a little boy. And I was a little boy in the late 1940s and early 1950s, and there were some among friends of my parents that would talk about her and say that same thing. And I hadn't heard it since then, and when I read that, I thought, well, I'll be doggone that Hitler wasn't the only one that felt that way. There were a lot of Southerners that did.
Yeah, and they ought to know because they were more familiar with the Southerners.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, this is just some wonderful stuff that he comes out with in these dinner conversations that you wouldn't get anywhere else. So it's very, very enjoyable, I think.
Right.
Okay, we can go on now.
Okay, the surest sign of the collapse of British domination in Egypt is the instructions given by the British Ministry of Information to the press to minimize the importance of Alexandria to the British Empire. For the British press is so well informed and accurately directed that it is only when, in the opinion of the government, some dominion or other portion of the empire cannot possibly be held any longer that it starts such tricks in an endeavor to turn public attention to some other portion of the Commonwealth. In the case of Egypt, the press story will have to be made very convincing, for while the loss of Hong Kong and Singapore has hit only the well-to-do classes, Egypt, for the man in the street, represents one of the most important props of British prosperity. For Churchill and his supporters, therefore, the loss of Egypt must inevitably give rise to fears of a considerable strengthening of the popular opposition. One must not lose sight of the fact that today there are already 21 members of Parliament who openly oppose Churchill, and even though the discipline of the voting system is invoked to silence them, it is not by methods such as these that Churchill will succeed in remaining in office. Only if he succeeds by a skillful handling of public opinion in turning popular attention from Egypt on to, say, India, will he be able to oppose with any chance of success a tremendously increased opposition. The Fuhrer stated that Garidi, the Turkish ambassador to Berlin, had been called to Ankara for consultation with the Turkish foreign minister. In this connection, the Fuhrer continued, "The fall of Sebastopol has roused the greatest jubilation in Ankara, and the hatred of the Turks for the Russians was given a free rein during the rejoicings. If, as a result, Garidi should be appointed foreign minister, we shall have no cause to complain. He is not admittedly a militant diplomat like Oshima, but he is a man who is absolutely convinced that Germany and Turkey must go forward hand in hand. Oshima and Garrady are without doubt the two ablest foreign diplomats at the moment in Berlin. Oshima is the more assured because he has in the Japanese armed forces an organization at his back which has both the knowledge and the power to control the political situation to the best advantage of the country. Garrady lacks any similarly strong support. The Turkish armed forces play no part in politics, and so he must needs further the interests of his country with the subtlety of a foil rather than the force of a saber. If Garrady should be appointed foreign minister, the problem of the Near East will, from our point of view, assume a totally different aspect. The other principal actor in this part of the world, the Grand Mufti, is also a realist rather than a dreamer where politics are concerned. With his blonde hair and blue eyes, he gives one the impression that he is, in spite of his sharp and mouse-like countenance, a man with more than one Aryan among his ancestors and one who may well be descended from the best Roman stock. In conversation, he shows himself to be a preeminently sly old fox. To gain time in which to think, he not infrequently has things translated to him, first into French and then into Arabic. And sometimes he carries his caution so far that he asks that certain points be committed straight away to writing. When he does speak, he weighs each word very carefully. His quite exceptional wisdom puts him almost on equal terms with the Japanese. And what cunning diplomats, the Japanese are, is exemplified by a small episode in the course of which I must confess, all but fell into a trap. Somebody had apparently put forward a theory at some time or other that because of their susceptibility to some sort of disturbance of the sense of balance, the Japanese could never become first-class air pilots. When the responsible Japanese statesman discovered that this twaddle was being swallowed whole by the gullible general staffs in various countries, they did their utmost to foster the idea. And behind this camouflage, they proceeded to build up an air force whose successes have astounded the world. I have myself often successfully applied the principle that when the representatives of a foreign power reach a conclusion which is faulty in itself, but which is in our interest that it be accepted as accurate, well, let well alone. When, after the assumption of power, I made a start with our rearmament program, I had to reckon with the certainty of countermeasures from the West. The current rumors of differences between the SS and the Reichswehr were, in this rather ticklish situation, of the greatest assistance to me. The French ambassador, François Poncet, greedily gobbled up all these rumors, and the more we fed them to him, the more emphatically did he report to Paris that any military intervention by France would be quite unnecessary, as the tension between the SS and the Reichswehr would undoubtedly develop in its own time into a life and death struggle. In the same way, the Rome Putsch was portrayed in François Poncet's reports as an internecine breaking of German heads in the hallowed manner of the Middle Ages, which would leave France at liberty to pull the chestnuts out of the fire as she wished. The Rome Putsch was thus of the greatest assistance to us in postponing the taking of any military measures by either France or Britain long enough for the progress of our rearmament to make any intervention by these powers impossible.
Mm-hmm. Well,
much more practical stuff, you know.
Yeah, right. You know, Hitler was, he reveals in here every once in a while that he's really thinking about all these things, and he's aware of so many things, because so much of this book is, he's talking about the kind of things you were saying you appreciated that he pays attention to. He's not talking about strategy and that so much, but
right.
Which would make sense that he wouldn't, but when he does, you see that he's pretty sharp about everything that's going on.
Sure. I really appreciated him bringing it out about Churchill and him, Hitler being so aware of the opposition to Churchill in Parliament. You know, he said 21 members of Parliament openly opposed Churchill. And, you know, for a nation at war like that, and you've got opposition that's speaking out against this stuff, that's extremely important. And it had to be to Germany, because the thing that they were hoping for was the British would come to their senses and realize this was not in their best interest. And since that wasn't going to happen, then the only other thing that could help them would be opposition among the British people themselves and the lower level politicians to what Churchill was doing. That maybe, you know, things kept getting worse and worse for them. The losses piling up, getting hungry at home with the blockades and the sinking of their ships. You had to have hope that this just might turn the tide and the British might say, "Hey, Uncle, you know, let's back off here." And so, uh-huh. But you know, and he's
yeah,
he
what
stays
he was always hoping for.
Yeah,
but you know that was going on right then. That censuring
yes.
of Churchill in, but it was only 21 out of like 300 or 200
right.
some or so. So it didn't turn out very strong, but it wasn't a sweep or anything. But it was made a big deal, and it was in all the papers. Churchill was really mad because making him look like he might be weak at this time when he needed to look strong. I've got a little bit about that at the end here, because he goes into this the results a little bit more before we come
uh-huh.
to an end here.
Okay.
So this is pretty interesting. This was, like I said, going on right now, right at this time.
Okay, we move on to 2nd July, 1942, at dinner. The Tyrolese in the Crimea, the struggle between the state and church, Joan of Arc, witch, patriotism and dynastic interests. I've just read a report by the Gauleiter Frauenfeld on the South Tyrol. In it, he proposes that the South Tyrolese should be transplanted en masse to the Crimea, and I think the idea is an excellent one. There are few places on earth in which a race can better succeed in maintaining its integrity for centuries on end than the Crimea. The Tartars and the Goths are the living proof of it. I think, too, that the Crimea will be both climatically and geographically ideal for the South Tyrolese, and in comparison with their present settlements, it'll be a real land of milk and honey. Their transfer to the Crimea presents neither physical nor psychological difficulty. All they have to do is sail down just one German waterway, the Danube, and they are there. The Fuhrer next addressed Bormann on the subject of some books which the latter had given him to read. The Fuhrer said, "The passages you have marked interest me very much indeed. It would really be most valuable if these books could be made available to all Germans, and particularly to leading men such as generals and admirals. For they do show that far from being the only one possessed of heretical ideas, I'm on the contrary in excellent company of many of the best of Germans. When one reads books on the subject of the state and the church, it is regrettable to see how often governments are only too ready to sacrifice the true interests of a people to those of some ideology or clique of vested interests. This is the only possible explanation for the fate of so great a heroine in the cause of freedom as Joan of Arc, portrayed incidentally much more faithfully by Shaw than by Schiller, who was betrayed, mark you, by the really influential French circles of the times and was burned as a witch. The attitude adopted in such cases by the courts of justice is admirably summed up by Ernst Haug in his thesis, The German National Anthem. In it, he shows how German courts, obsessed with the petty interests of their own little states and blind to the vital interests of the German nation as a whole, had the impertinence to stigmatize as unpatriotic the songs of freedom written by that great German, Hoffmann von Fallersleben. With such facts before us, we must regard it as an achievement of high merit that the Habsburg monarchy steadfastly upheld the pan-Germanic ideal even throughout the period when Germany was divided into a number of petty states and torn asunder by conflicting dynastic issues."
Well, this is kind of a short section, but there's a lot of little interesting things in it. Well, I'll just start at the bottom. He's giving a compliment to the Habsburgs here. I thought that was pretty outstanding. Saying that, you know, that they did uphold the pan-Germanic ideal.
Correct.
So I thought that was nice of him. And talking about the Tyrolese, they're called the South Tyrolese. That's right at the top of Italy, between Italy and Germany, that little state, a little area that's always been in dispute, kind of. But the population is majority Austro-Bavarian heritage, and they speak German. But one quarter of Tyrol speaks Italian. I don't know what it would be today, but it's still mostly German speaking there. But Hitler didn't dispute it and left it with the Italians because they were his ally. So the people, the Germans there in Tyrol, really wanted to be part of Germany. They're very disappointed. Even I don't know how they would feel today. Actually, Germany is such a mess. But
that's right.
And then Austria separated, so they really would be a part of Austria, I guess. So anyway, the this Hoffmann von Wallersleben is a German poet, was a German poet, and he's best known for writing Das Lied der Deutschen, which is what he's mentioning here, the German national anthem.
National anthem, uh-huh.
Yeah, and the third stanza of what he wrote in his full song was what the national anthem of Germany uses today, just the third stanzas. We know they don't like the wording of too much nationalism, too much love of Germany and the rest of it. So they just use the third stanza. And he also wrote is best known for a number of popular children's songs. So he was just a real sweet guy. Now, well, that's all I have. Oh, yeah, Joan of Arc. Joan of Arc.
Yes.
You see, now he calls her a great hero. And these books by Bormann, that Bormann loaned to him,
uh-huh.
They had to be anti-Christian books, right? Anti-church books.
That's exactly right.
People writing, you know, essayists or writers, you know, who were expressing that. And so Bormann said, you need to read this. He probably pointed out certain passages. And they were probably pretty good. But so that's what this is all about, because Joan of Arc was eventually persecuted by the church. And she was a totally faithful Catholic, you know. And then whatever she went out to do, I'm not real clear about her. I mean, I understand her story, but I'm not real clear on the details right now. But I know that I don't really know why they burned her. Now, do you? Why did they turn against her? Because
the leadership of the church and all were afraid of her because of the her popularity with the masses and with the military that she had led. And you would have thought
that's right.
They'd been eternally grateful. But they felt threatened. The church as an institution of power felt threatened by her. And she was very dedicated Catholic to her religion
that's right. She became like a general and was leading troops into battle and doing pretty well.
That's
interesting,
she was.
Ray. Yeah, that would fit. That's it. That's the church for you, and this is what he's complaining about, the way the church can't go along with the state. It has to be in charge.
Well, and that's true, and, you know, when he's, Hitler says this, and this is what you were getting at a minute ago, he's reading these books that Bormann gave him, and he said, boy, the passages that you marked really interest me a lot. And then he says, hey, you know, I kind of felt empathy here, and I felt vindication because I look at these things, these leading men such as generals and admirals, would like this, for them to see this sort of thing, because he said, because what you've marked here shows that far from being the only one possessed of heretical ideas, I am on the contrary in the excellent company of many of the best of the Germans. And that meant a lot to me because, you know, he kind of keeps his mouth closed a lot of times about, you know, when in Rome and speaking out against the church and things like this. But when he reads something like that, and those people have those same kind of thoughts that of the negative effect of the church and its control or trying to control policy and whatever has had on the nation in different historical aspects, he says, hey, you know, those people feel like about them just exactly like I do, so I'm not alone in
my
ideas.
They must have been written by highly respected Germans.
Yes.
You know, German scholars,
right,
and so on. Or he wouldn't have said it that way. So he's saying, hey, I'm in good company here.
Yeah, the best of the Germans, yeah.
Right.
I kind of felt that way myself in some of the things I've read. I say, oh, looky here. I thought I might be the only one. I'm sure glad somebody else felt that way.
Right.
Oh, boy. Okay. Moving on to the 2nd of July, 1942, after dinner. The British press gets its orders. Egypt's hour of liberation. Dr. Dietrich presented a report which showed that the British government had, in fact, issued instructions to the British press along exactly the lines which the Führer had foretold at lunch the day before. The line taken was that while the loss of India would entail the inevitable disintegration of the empire, the abandonment of Egypt would increase the difficulties of the German high command rather than those of Great Britain. The destruction of harbors and roads, coupled with the mining of the Suez Canal, would, it was emphasized, so compromise its vital lines of communication and supply that Egypt might well become a death trap for the German Africa Corps. The Führer remarked, I certainly did not expect Britain to write off Egypt with such celerity. It is now very important that our own propaganda machine should come swiftly into action and trumpet throughout the world and with ever-increasing stridency that for Egypt the day of freedom has at last dawned. If the slogan is skillfully handled, its effect on other countries under British domination, and particularly on those in the Near East, will be tremendous. It is also of great importance that the King of Egypt should be urged to withdraw as quickly as possible from British protection, secrete himself somewhere or other, and wait for us solemnly to invite his return and formally to restore his throne to him. It is the task of the Foreign Office to give the King a hint along these lines. To me, this is a very, very important incident here because, as I've told you before, my friend that I came to know 30 or 40 years ago was born and raised in Alexandria, Egypt, became a neurosurgeon, and came to the United States and whatever, but talking to him about history, he said that his father, and this man was the same as me, so he was born in 1943, so he was just a baby during that time, but he said when he was growing up, his father and father's friends would talk about those days and would be very, very pleased that the Germans kicked the British out of there because they, so many of the common folks in Egypt didn't care for the British because of their pompous and audacity and all, and they were hoping that the Germans would run them off. And then to see this written like here, like Britain says, okay, so we lost Egypt, so what? It's going to be more trouble for the Germans now than us letting go of it, you know, which was just a whistling in the dark operation.
Well, it just shows that's their propaganda. Nobody puts out more propaganda, in the
British.
Sense of false propaganda, to fool
that's
people,
right,
than the British. And they're churning stuff out all the time. And Hitler predicted it just a day or 2 days before. And then that's exactly what they did. They said, oh, it's not going to hurt us. They want their people to be upset. You see, they're always dealing. It's all about making sure that your own people will go along with things and won't start grumbling and saying, hey, we don't like your leadership, you see. This leadership is bad. So they have to put out these kind of lies. This is just, like you say, a great example of it. And in fact, the timeline for this day, I wasn't sure what day this date this was, but what we just read was on the 2nd of July.
Yes.
And the timeline for the 2nd is that Churchill survives a censure motion in the House of Commons, what we were talking about earlier. And I've got a little part of it that you can read the whole thing, the whole deal that went on from the notes from the whatever records of the Parliament. But I've got a few things that I, just two paragraphs here that I copied out. And it says, the military misfortunes of the last fortnight in Cyrenaica and Egypt have completely transformed the situation, not only in that theater, but throughout the Mediterranean. This is the complaint against him, part of it. We have lost upwards of 50,000 men, wow, by far the larger proportion of whom are prisoners, a great mass of material, and in spite of carefully organized demolitions, large quantities of stores have fallen into the enemy's hands. Rommel has advanced nearly 400 miles through the desert and is now approaching the fertile delta of the Nile. The evil effects of these events in Turkey, in Spain, in France, and in French North Africa cannot yet be measured. We are at this moment in the presence of a recession of our hopes and prospects in the Middle East and in the Mediterranean, unequaled since the fall of France. If there are any would-be profiteers of disaster who feel able to paint the picture in darker colors, they are certainly at liberty to do so. Well, that's just part of what they were bringing up against Churchill as to why they were very unhappy with how he was leading this. Oh, they were, some were accusing him of not building the right kind of planes, you know, too many of this and not enough of that. And just like the debate they were having in Germany, it turns out they were having that in England, too, about is your Air Force leader there building the right kind of planes? Because when this happened, we didn't have the planes we needed. And if we had had some more intervention fighters or something, we could have set off something else from happening. So Churchill says, there is no doubt that this bomber offensive against Germany is one of the most powerful means we have of carrying on an offensive war against Germany. We did not like it when the Blitz was on, but we bore it. Everyone knows that it was the main preoccupation of the government and the municipal authorities of that day, with factories being delayed in their work, ports congested, and so forth. We, at any rate, had hope. We felt that we were on the rising tide. More was coming to us, and moreover, we were buoyed by the sympathy of the world. And he quotes, London can take it, unquote. That's what people were saying. That, no doubt, that was the London was putting that out, and the rest of the world was picking it up. London can take it. That was part of their propaganda. Uh-huh. No such consolations, Churchill says, are available in Germany. Nobody speaks with admiration and says, Cologne can take it. They say, serve them right. That is the view of the civilized world. In addition to that, they know that this attack is not going to get weaker. It is going to get continually stronger until, in my view, it will play a great and perfectly definite part in abridging the course of this war, in taking the strain off our Russian allies, and in reducing the building and construction of submarines and other weapons of war. Of course, one would like to have had both, but at this moment, much though we need transport aircraft, I am not at all sure if I were offered a gift of 1,000 heavy bombers or 1,000 transports, which I should choose. I should take advice. Well, I didn't copy any more of it, but so he knew that he was going to do as much damage to Germany as they did do, and then that was the only good plan he had. He didn't know how else to beat them. So they were questioning that in this thing in Parliament, but he stood up for it, and I thought that's pretty revealing too. Putting the Germans down, everybody says London can take it, but nobody's saying Cologne can take it because they know they deserve it because they're not civilized. It's all just, Anyway, and then on the 3rd, Guadalcanal is now firmly in the hands of the Japanese.
So we've got
one more section to read here.
Okay, July 3rd, 1942, at dinner. Transport by ship and plane. The future belongs to the air. When the Fuhrer came to table, Captain Aviation Bauer and Admiral Kroenke were discussing the relative profits earned by air and maritime transportation. The Fuhrer said, increasing speeds in the air have already been assured. And in my opinion, an increase in profits will be achieved by aviation only through the introduction of the diesel engine. Bauer remarked that a passenger aircraft required a payload of 60 to 100 passengers. The Fuhrer continued, "You need not worry about that. In a very short time, we shall have aircraft big enough to have bathrooms installed in them." Admiral Kroenke said that in spite of all these anticipated developments in aviation, maritime transportation had nothing to fear from air competition. "I cannot believe," he said, "that it will ever be possible to build aircraft big enough to replace cargo ships as carriers of coal, timber, iron, etc." Bauer retorted, "Not necessary. As it is, the railways have left the carrying of tiles to the ships." The Fuhrer concluded, "One must judge these things in the light of common progress. The bird is 1 degree in advance of the flying fish, which itself is higher than the ordinary fish. And in the same way, the aircraft is an advance on the ship, and the future belongs to the air." And it certainly proved out there.
I guess so. I was wondering what is the status of ships and things floating on the water these days. They're certainly not as important as the aircraft in any kind of a war, I don't think. But they're still important. They still have an important place for, I mean, you still have to have them. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, see, these people, see, they'll argue, I think this, I think that, and Hitler always has the wise thing to say. Isn't that interesting, you know? He can cut through all that and point to what's really, what you should really be looking at.
You and Carolyn, today you look at the United States military and its extensive use of the big, massive C-47s, and those things carry tanks, they carry half-track trucks.
God.
Everything like this, see. Now, of course, that was not near possible back there in this day that we're reading about right now. But Hitler was saying that the future belongs to the air. Now, when they had to ship equipment like that to the front, they had to do it by rail or made, you know, of course, by ships for Americans, big LSTs and things like this. But now they can do it by air. And what does that tell you about the time it takes to get that equipment to the front where they're going to fight the battles?
Right.
If you do it by air, you're at a tremendous advantage. So he was exactly right with his analysis.
He sure was. Well, this was a good program tonight, and we're ready to close out the show for tonight, listeners. So do you have any concluding things you want to say before we go off the air, Ray?
Well, just that I have really enjoyed this section. As usual, there's just pertinent things that jump out at you, and you pick up on so much. I'm enjoying this continuing study, and I appreciate the people that are with us and listening and occasionally drop a line to you and the job that you're doing and we're getting done here with this book.
Yeah, so, I think it's great. I forgot something I was going to mention. There's still a couple of minutes. You know, the preceding section here mentioned Otto Dietrich, Hitler's press secretary. And it was some conversation going on when I was dealing with the commenter at my website that about Nietzsche and Hitler and so on. And it turned out that Otto Dietrich was arrested after the war. And the book that he wrote, Hitler, I don't know which title it was, but he wrote a book about Hitler. But he was in captivity at the time. And Hanning Scott has started translating something by Dietrich that he was writing. His website is nationalsocialistworldview.blogspot.com. And it shows Dietrich in it with a very, very pro-national socialism attitude, and I think a lot happened to him after the end of the war and then that Nuremberg trial, and they were giving all this stuff to all these National Socialist leaders about the concentration camps and so on and what happened, and saying it was all proved, and they had no way to know otherwise. And a lot of them, you know, ended up kind of falling for it and thinking, wow, what was I supporting here? You know, this is terrible.
Yeah.
So they started talking a little bit differently. But I, Hadding's just got a start on that. He's going to continue doing more. So it'll be interesting. He's writing a philosophy of National Socialism. It's going to be interesting to read
sure.
what he has written. So I'll talk about that more next week maybe. And
ladies
and gentlemen, thanks. Good night. I'm going to close off right now.